This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Conversation with Julia Wheeler, Alev Scott.
Hello, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival, and in particular to this event, An Ottoman Odyssey. I've got plenty of copies of that there, and I can commend it before we even start. Alev, welcome.
Hello.
To the festival and to the stage. First of all, just tell us about your links with Turkey.
My links with Turkey, well, my mother, who is somewhere here,
hello.
is from Cyprus, in fact, from northern Cyprus. My grandmother was, in fact, born under the penultimate sultan, Mehmet IV, in 1918 in Cyprus. And I spend a lot of my childhood in Cyprus as well. And about 8 or 9 years ago, I suppose, I went to live in Istanbul and I worked there as a journalist, sort of taught myself Turkish again, and I suppose I reconnected with my Turkish and specifically my Ottoman roots, because of course Turkey is a relatively young country. So those are my links, and I lived in Istanbul for about 6 years.
You say that you went back to the language. How much of it had you spoken as a child growing up, or was it more about listening?
I did speak it as a young child with my grandmother in particular, because she didn't speak English. She spoke Turkish. So I learnt it very young, but after she died, I didn't speak it for quite some time. So when I arrived in Istanbul, I had a kind of child's vocabulary, child's understanding of grammar. And I kind of had to go back to basics, really. It was quite a strange experience, but it definitely worth it, because I think an understanding of language obviously brings you closer to the culture, and it really helped me to understand the country of Turkey a lot better.
So when you went to Istanbul, what sorts of things were you reporting on?
So I worked as a freelance journalist for The Guardian, BBC, Newsweek, various publications, and I was there at a very interesting time. So I arrived in January 2011, when actually, believe it or not, President Erdogan, he was prime minister at that point, he was still relatively popular, and it was quite an exciting time to be there. The economy was doing really well. People were quite kind of hopeful. People were working hard. There was a lot of entrepreneurial spirit. It was a very exciting city to be in, Istanbul, at that time. And then, of course, things started deteriorating. In 2013, there were the Gezi Park protests. And that was sort of the beginning of things really going sour.
So what were the protests about? Just remind
us. So the Gezi Park protests, they started as an environmental protest, in fact, because in the middle of Istanbul, there is Taksim Square, which has huge political and historical significance as a place of protest. And I actually lived 2 minutes' walk from Taksim Square, so I really had a ringside seat at the protest. What happened was there was a government contract to raise Taksim Square, build a huge shopping mall and some kind of barracks, I think, some kind of replication of an Islamic barracks that had been there in the Ottoman era. And it would destroy a park, Gezi Park. And people didn't want that, locals didn't want that, so they went and they camped and they tried to stop the bulldozers. And then it became so much bigger than that. It became a symbol for standing up to government corruption, government sort of shit, you know, just the fact that they could give a contract to someone to just destroy this historical square made people very angry. So it turned into something much bigger. There were calls for Erdogan to resign. It was really huge, and it spread across Turkey. So it started in Gezi, it started in the park, and then it spread throughout Istanbul, it spread to Ankara, Izmir, which is a major city on the west coast of Turkey. It went into small towns and villages, in fact, all over Turkey. And that was when the clampdown really began and the government got more and more authoritarian. And then, of course, there was the attempted coup in 2016. which I was also in Istanbul for, and I left shortly after that because the situation became impossible for journalists.
Okay, so let's leave your story there for a moment and go back in time.
Yeah.
The Ottoman Empire, tell us how far it spread, how it rose, and how it managed to continue for so long.
Yeah, it was, I mean, an extraordinary empire that people often forget lasted until, you know, less than 100 years ago. So the Republic of Turkey, the current sort of state of Turkey, was only founded in 1923. So the Ottoman Empire started, you know, way back in really the 12th century in terms of its roots in Anatolia. And then, you know, 15th century, Istanbul became the capital of the Ottoman Empire. And it was absolutely enormous. I mean, it spread from Mecca in the south to, you know, Algiers, Tbilisi in Georgia, Odessa. It went up really to the gates of Vienna. And so huge swathes of the Middle East and the Balkans, Turkey itself, obviously, Greece. It was all Ottoman. And so at its peak in the 17th century, it covered an enormous amount of land, and it encompassed people of you know, Christian, Jewish, Muslim backgrounds, many, many different languages, different types of people. And I think its diversity was the clue to why it lasted so long.
Well, that's interesting. Why? I mean, we think about diversity as perhaps bits breaking off.
Yeah.
So how did the diversity feed into that longevity?
Well, I think when an empire is that enormous, it's necessarily going to be diverse. So it can only exist if it can allow all those people to live together. If the Ottomans had tried to impose Islam and, you know, the Turkish language on all its subjects, it wouldn't have worked, you know. And that's actually the key to quite a lot of empires. If you think about it, I mean, the Roman Empire, they allowed for local religions to, you know, in this country is a good example. You know, we have Bath, for example, where my parents live. The Romans knew it as Aquae Sulis, and they actually merged local deities with Roman deities to ensure that people felt included and felt that they could continue to worship as they wanted to, because otherwise you have too much resistance and it just doesn't work. So, and in fact, the Ottoman Empire began to break down when that diversity was challenged and when the later Ottoman sultans became paranoid that they weren't powerful enough and they tried to impose certain strictures that just didn't work. Mm.
So there was an element, I get the impression from your book, there's an element of pay the taxes and we'll leave you alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's pick out a few of your favourite sultans, because we know we've said that.
Sultans.
So Suleiman the Magnificent, what made him magnificent?
Suleiman the Magnificent was by far the most magnificent sultan. So he ruled the Ottoman Empire really at its zenith, or maybe just after its zenith, but he was responsible for a lot of the reforms that made it incredibly modern for the time, and even by our standards. Like, he completely redrew the laws. He was an incredibly fair taxer. So there's this famous story of when too much tax came from the Egyptians during his reign, and he noticed this, and he made sure that it was given back to the Egyptians.
Well, that's
and,
quite refreshing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite unusual. And he was he was very ambitious. But he didn't have the bloodthirsty reputation that a lot of other sultans had. So, for example, there's Selim the Grim, who massacred a huge number of Alevis in southeast Anatolia, kind of near Iran, actually. And you know, that's given him the name Selim the Grim, which lasts till today. He was sort of an impressive sultan in his own way, but he had a very different legacy to someone like Suleiman the Magnificent, who also presided over a period of incredible cultural wealth. And he was sultan at a time where Constantinople, Istanbul, was sort of one of the most wonderful places in the world to visit. Mm. Arguably still is, although it's fast losing that title, sadly.
Mm. So what... You touched on it, that it was the reduction of that diversity. It was the growth of nationalism that started to cause a sway and a rumble.
Yeah, definitely. Well, obviously, a lot of places were in a state of flux in the early 20th century, and the First World War was the last straw for the Ottoman Empire. They picked the wrong side, the Sultan and specifically the Young Turks forged an alliance with the Kaiser, and they lost, obviously, and they lost. But they'd already been losing parts of their empire, significant parts of that territory that they once had, particularly in the Balkans. They'd lost Greece, you know, quite some time before. In 1912, there was the First Balkan War. They lost Bulgaria, Macedonia, and so on. So things were deteriorating, and the First World War just sort of finished them off. And if it hadn't been for Atatürk, who was the founder of the Republic of Turkey, who managed to fight off the Allies, specifically the Greeks, that there would be no state of Turkey. So something was salvaged, but obviously a once enormous empire was very much reduced. Mm.
So what is the story then that Turks tell themselves now? What do they think of when they think of Atatürk?
It's actually a very complicated question because it depends entirely on who you ask. I would say that the majority of Turks still think of Atatürk as, he was undoubtedly a founding father, but they also have a strong emotional attachment to him. You know, school children in Turkey learn his speeches off by heart, his face is everywhere. He has a significance emotionally for Turks that I can't think of any equivalent in, certainly in the Western world. You know, even if you think of great characters like Winston Churchill or, I don't know, Abraham Lincoln or whoever, they're great heroes of history that people have attachments to, but there's something about Atatürk that goes far beyond that for Turks. I would say that his legacy has been challenged recently by the current Turkish government, who are a great deal more Islamic than most governments of Turkey have been since Atatürk's day. Atatürk was a famous secularist. He specifically wanted Turkey to be a secular country. He thought that's the only way that in the modern world, in the 20th century, Turkey could survive and hold its head up high with the West. And he made great efforts to separate church and state, I mean, Islam and the state. Things are changing, and I think Erdogan is probably the most powerful leader, whether you like him or not. He is the most powerful leader Turkey has had since Atatürk, and it's a very interesting clash of ideals going on right now in Turkey. But to answer your question, I think most Turks do still feel an enormous sense of gratitude and admiration to Atatürk.
And does that hold true also for people of Turkish descent who you met in the former Ottoman Empire?
That's a more complicated question because, I mean, for the purposes of my book, I was specifically seeking out communities who identified with their Ottoman past. So, for example, in the Balkans, in South Serbia and in Kosovo and in Bosnia, I met Muslims who thought of themselves as Ottoman. And they looked at Erdogan as an equivalent modern sultan. And they didn't really feel Turkish. I didn't see any photos of Atatürk around. They didn't talk about him. They talked about Erdogan and they talked about the Ottoman Empire, and that's where their sense of loyalty lay. Same with a lot of Palestinians I interviewed for example, in East Jerusalem. There were photos of Erdogan on the wall. There weren't photos of Atatürk. Atatürk is more of a Turkish symbol. He's very much a Turkish symbol. Whereas Erdogan, because he explicitly plays the Islamic card in his sort of foreign appeal, he's cultivated that. He cultivates himself very consciously as a modern sultan in many ways. And it sort of works. I think people, Muslims in areas that used to be under Ottoman control, really do think of him as like a kind of reincarnation of the great Ottoman sultans. Mm.
I think it would be fair to say that this wasn't the book that you thought you were going to write.
No.
Because your own circumstances changed.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
The book was originally going to be more about Turkey. My first book was very much about modern Turkey and the politics of modern Turkey and how it's changed in recent years. But this book was going to be about the Ottoman history of Turkey and how it's visible today if you go to certain areas of the country and in its sort of hidden religions. Everyone assumes that Turkey is basically entirely Sunni Muslim, very homogenous. And that's not really the case. That's sort of officially the case, but in fact there's a Jewish community, much smaller than it used to be, but still there is a Jewish community. There's a Christian community. There are Armenians, there are Greeks, and there are Alevis who are Muslim, but certainly not Sunni Muslim. So there's a lot of diversity that isn't acknowledged in Turkey, and that was my area of interest. That's what I wanted to write about. But while I was researching the book, sort of halfway through, and after I'd left Turkey to sort of let things cool down after the coup attempt, I discovered that I was barred from the country. So I couldn't return to continue the research that I'd begun. I mean, I had some research under my belt, but it could no longer be the book that I set out to write. So I went and I talked to my publishers at River Run, and I said, I'm sorry, I can't deliver your book anymore. And they said, OK, well, what can you deliver? And I said, well, we could make this much bigger and more ambitious, and I could travel to lots of different places of the former Ottoman Empire. I can go to Palestine, I can go to Serbia, I can go to Armenia and just see what happens. And they said, okay, go and do what you can. So I did, and this is the result.
That's a classic case of one door closes and then, to be honest, 12 others open up, don't
they?
Yeah,
I remember having a conversation with my agent, in fact, around the time that this reordering of the book was happening, and I was feeling very sorry for myself because I'd just been kicked out of Turkey and it was, you know, sad times. And she, in her very sort of brisk, matter-of-fact way, said, yes, but now the book will be much better. And I said, well, yeah, I suppose so. It will make a more interesting book. And she saw it very much from a sort of professional point of view, that this was a good opportunity and it was kind of a good thing to have happened. And at that point, I really didn't see it her way.
So that's interesting. The idea that that was something that was very personal to you, I wonder how you then related to people whose families found themselves in exactly that situation where they couldn't go back to their homelands. And I'm thinking particularly, you know, around the creation of Turkey.
Yeah.
Because there's you describe a situation where you're sitting writing and you can see Turkey beyond the sea, and so you're thinking, yeah, you know, I kind of get an idea of how this is to not be able to go back to what I, you know, maybe not in your case, but to my homeland.
Yes. Yeah, well, certainly. I wrote a lot of the book on the island of Lesbos, which is extremely... It's one of the closest islands, Greek islands, to Turkey. And if you're on the east coast, as I was, you can literally look and see Turkey right there. And I knew that area of Turkey very well. I used to go on holiday there all the time. And it was weird. It was very strange to think, well, at a pinch, I could probably swim to Turkey from here. But I'm not allowed, and that's very strange. And as you say, it relates to during the creation of Turkey, just before, there was a population exchange between Greece and Turkey of their relative minorities. So the Greek Orthodox Ottoman subjects of Turkey were sent back to Greece. They were sent to Greece. They'd never been there before, most likely. They didn't speak Greek, but suddenly they were told that this is your homeland, actually. And Muslim Ottoman subjects living in Greece were sent back to Turkey. So there was there is a very interesting relationship between Greece and Turkey and the sort of symbiotic nature of their existence, but also the tensions between them. And I now live in Greece, and I find that almost everyone has a story of how their grandparents or great-grandparents were, you know, originally from Istanbul or Cappadocia or Izmir, which they call Smyrna, or so the ties are very, very close.
And you write very movingly about Cyprus, having been there on childhood holidays, but then going to different parts or going across that border from a different direction.
Yeah,
was that? I mean, that's the kind of the microcosm of that Turkish Greek. Tension,
in a way, yeah. And, you know, my grandmother was actually born in the south of Cyprus, which is now known as Greek Cyprus. And she grew up speaking Greek as well as Turkish, and a lot of her friends were Greek Cypriots. And when I was a child and we were on holiday in the north, the border was closed. So, you know, if you were a Turkish Cypriot, you lived in the north, you couldn't go to the south. Now the border's open. And in fact, when I go to Cyprus, I have to fly into the south and then go across the land border into the north. Whereas before, as a child, I used to fly into the north via Turkey, and I would never go to the south. So things have really changed, both politically, in Cyprus, and also for me personally in terms of my ability to move freely or not so freely.
And the younger people that you meet there, do you get the impression that this legacy will continue, or are people actually keen and determined to change it?
It's a really difficult question. I think I would say that on balance, the young people I've met are in favour of unification. They don't see the point of the division anymore. The older generations are more divided, ironically, on that. But it's almost not really a question of what the people want, because these things are in... it's just a totally sort of entrenched political quagmire where not just Greek and Turkish Cypriot leaders, but Greece and Turkey, the governments of Greece and Turkey, and the UN are all involved, and there is a lot of players, it's very messy, and every couple of years someone will say, oh, it looks like Cyprus really is uniting, finally, and it never does. I mean, I hope it will, but I don't think it will in the near future.
So that's one side of the legacy of the Ottoman Empire, but you also, on your travels, found other examples that were actually more concrete. I'm thinking of the sort of architectural side of things.
Stone, not concrete, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, probably concrete now that they've been restored.
Well, yeah, so the Balkans in particular is a place where there are many, many architectural remains of the Ottoman Empire. Mosques, obviously, hammams, just big government buildings, bridges, all sorts. And the Turkish government is currently putting a lot of money into restoring them. And some of it's kind of pretty impressive, actually, and they're spending a lot of money on it. But what I found interesting was the reasons why they're doing that, why they're ploughing all this money into resurrecting the influence of the Ottoman Empire. And they're also putting money into building brand new mosques. And it's very much a kind of modern imperialism, as far as I can see.
And what about in the Holy Land?
The Holy Land. Yes. So, well, Jerusalem was probably one of the most tense places I've ever been. And I think it's a very sad example of a place where there used to be a lot more tolerance and genuine coexistence than there is today. So I think we'd like to imagine, you know, that the world is getting more tolerant and diversity is more embraced than it used to be. But that's certainly not the case in Jerusalem. And I found it very sad to read about the level of friendship and trust between, for example, Jewish and Muslim families in Jerusalem that there used to be as recently as the beginning of the 20th century. And just think about how that is today. I mean, I don't know how many people have gone to Jerusalem, but it's tense.
How many people have been to Jerusalem here? Okay,
right.
You're such
quite
a well-travelled bunch.
You are well-travelled.
Fantastic.
I don't know whether you felt this as well, but it's a diverse place, but it's not... I don't feel it as a kind of... a place where people genuinely get along, to put it sort of politely. And, you know, I was reading about families... A very common practice in Jerusalem in the early 20th century was if a mother had a child and she couldn't breastfeed that child... And say she was a Muslim, an Arab, or a Christian, whatever, and she couldn't breastfeed that child, but her neighbour had just had children and she was breastfeeding, she would just give her baby to her neighbour, and that woman would breastfeed her baby as if it were her own. And the children of these two families would be milk siblings. You'd have a milk brother or a milk sister, and that would mean that you'd breastfed from the same woman. And that was very common between, you know, it didn't matter. It was a matter of practicality. People did it, you know, because they couldn't breastfeed, but also it was symbolic of a trust and ease within these communities that just doesn't exist today. I cannot imagine. I just can't imagine that happening today. And it's not just there. It happened in, for example, Thessaloniki, which was another huge... They actually called Thessaloniki the Jerusalem of the Balkans. And before the state of Greece was founded in the 19th century, it was by far the most important city in Greece. And it was hugely diverse. It was very, very Jewish. So, in fact, one of the predominant languages, or perhaps the most predominant language, was Ladino, which is a kind of Sephardic Spanish. And there was a huge number of Jews there, and this practice of milk siblings, milk mothers, milk siblings, was common there as well. And then... I mean, there is still a Jewish community in Thessaloniki today, Salonika, but it's, you know, not nearly what it... And that, partly that's because of the Nazi occupation during the Second World War in Greece. And almost the entire Jewish population of Thessaloniki was sent to concentration camps in Germany and Austria. But, yeah, I think that's something that I found really sad, actually. And one of the ways in which I felt we've really regressed.
Where did you find hope?
Hope. Maybe Cyprus. Hope, that's interesting. I don't know, Beirut is a very complicated place and it's definitely got a lot of problems. But I feel like there's a proportion of the youth there which they're trying to challenge the really quite weird political system there.
And they're trying diversity go to
yeah,
Beirut.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Huge diversity, obviously, in Beirut, but also huge problems in the sense that the way that these various communities and religions are represented in parliament is bizarre. And it looks fair, so, you know, the president, the prime minister, the defence minister, they all have to be from different religions, basically. But it's a bit strange and arbitrary. It was created by the French ages ago, and it definitely needs to be changed. But there's been no real impetus to change until now. And I interviewed some young political activists who were trying to change that. And, yeah, there's hope. I wouldn't say that I think it's in the bag and Beirut's going to be the most... you know, harmonious place ever from now on, but I'd say there is some hope there, yeah.
So within this book, you can get a sense that it's really grounded in research and fact, and you really know your stuff. When you were in Beirut, when you go to meet the Druze warlord and then the Sheikh, there is also adventure. It's quite intrepid. Yeah. I mean, you must have felt quite intrepid. Tell us the story there.
So in Beirut, I met a man called Walid Jumblat, who has been quite a figure in Lebanese politics for quite some time. He's the leader of the Druze community. So the Druze community, not many people know about outside of Lebanon. I think the most well-known person is probably Amal Clooney, who is from a Druze community in Lebanon. But they're pretty obscure to the outside world, I suppose.
Interesting, though, Amal Clooney has kind of broken one of the rules, which is
yes.
That you shouldn't marry out.
You should not marry out of the Druze community.
But it is George.
Sorry?
It is George.
It is George,
yeah.
So she can be forgiven. But, yeah, so the Druze community is one of the many actors in the Lebanese civil war and who are still sort of, you know, still those tensions brewing. But Walid Jumblat is a very interesting character because he's controversial. He is a warlord. I mean, he's responsible for quite a lot of conflict. He's very cynical, very, very cynical. So I first got interested in him because I read... an interview he gave to Playboy magazine in, I believe, 1982, perhaps. I think it was 1982. And in which he was at the Geneva Peace Convention trying to solve the Lebanese war. And he said something like, yeah, we're here because we have to be, but everyone knows they're not going to work, these peace talks. But, you know, you do what you've got to do. Sometimes you just need to attend these things. Everyone knows they won't work. He's very cynical. And he's seen a lot. And anyway, I had dinner with him. And I told him that I wanted to go and interview some sheikhs, some Druze sheikhs who live on Mount Hermon near the Israeli border. And he arranged that for me. But another thing I did with his wife that was quite interesting was we went to the Syrian border, where at that point ISIS had control of the town we were going to, a town called Arsal. And there was a huge refugee camp full of Sunni Syrian refugees there. And we effectively, me and Walid Jumblat's wife, effectively sort of embedded with the Lebanese army, which was a really interesting experience, because I think from my British and my Turkish backgrounds, I sort of assumed that if you're with a load of soldiers and some tanks, you're going to be fine, because the army, you know, armies are powerful and you're well protected. And it didn't really occur to me that the Lebanese army would be quite so afraid of being in this part of Lebanon, because also you wouldn't expect, certainly speaking as a Turk, I wouldn't expect to go with some Turkish soldiers to anywhere in Turkey and feel that I wasn't with the upper hand, you know, that you... and yet these Lebanese soldiers were terrified, and rightly so. I mean, it was held by ISIS, and we were up on this sort of outpost, and there were sandbags everywhere, and it was, when I got there I realised it was quite a dangerous situation. Luckily it was fine in the end, but that was very interesting, because I got to see how the army kind of socially works. So there are certain ranks which are basically preserved for Christians, most of the privates are Muslim. That creates quite a lot of resentment, and it's extremely political, because the army, as well as along with many other institutions in Lebanon, is divided on religious grounds, along religious lines. So it's just a bizarre institution. But I interviewed sort of all the different ranks, and they were all different religions. And there was a Greek Orthodox guy I talked to. I think he might have been a lieutenant. And I said, well, what's your career trajectory? What are you aiming for? And he said, well, I suppose I'm aiming for the top. And I said, well, what's the top? And he said, well, defence minister. Defence minister is always a Greek Orthodox in Lebanon. And I just thought that was so strange, that, you know, if you were Muslim or Druze, you couldn't be defence minister.
It's so very different from equal opportunities.
Very much so. You know. But the thing is, it's done under the guise of giving everyone a bite of the apple.
And does it?
I mean, in a way, it does. I mean, it could be that, you know, there could be a version of Lebanon where only Christians ever got the top posts, or only Muslims ever got the top posts. So the French organise it in certain ways that doesn't happen. If you're a Sunni, if you're a Druze, if you're a Shiite, you will have somewhere high up, a high up post to aim for. But it's not open to all. That's the payoff.
We touched on the Holy Land, Israel, and the Palestinian territories. An area that you bring out and make parallels with that area is Armenia. Mm. Armenia and Turkey, and how Armenians define themselves, really. Tell us about the history that's gone on there.
Yeah, well, Armenia was a sort of emotional place for me to go to, because I went to the Genocide Museum just outside Yerevan. And Turkey obviously doesn't officially recognise the genocide. And it was very strange to go there as a Turk and go into a place which sort of set out to prove the existence of something that officially Turks aren't meant to believe in. But personally, my biggest connection with Armenia and Armenians in general was in Jerusalem, because there I met an Armenian man called George in his 70s. And he was the son of two Armenians who had to flee the genocide in Turkey in 1915. And they'd come to Jerusalem and they'd sought sanctuary in a monastery, St. James Monastery, in sort of the middle of Jerusalem. And so George grew up in Jerusalem speaking Turkish with his parents, and he'd never been to their hometown in Turkey. He had no real connection with Turkey, and yet, because his parents were so homesick for Turkey, despite being Armenian, despite being refugees, despite being victims of the genocide indirectly, they really miss Turkey, and so they would tell him stories of their home village, they would speak to him in Turkish, they would teach him songs. And when he met me, he was so excited to talk to me in Turkish. And so we talked, and it was just a very surreal experience to talk Turkish with an Armenian, a man whose parents had fled the genocide in 1915. And there he was, desperate to talk to me in Turkish, and with very fond, indirect memories of this country that his parents had been expelled from. And that was a very profound experience.
And did you find that elsewhere in the former Ottoman Empire, that there's that kind of the heartstrings still go back there? Sometimes there's the myth of return as well, that, you know, people often say the British are more, you know, you kind of hanker after home, don't you, if you're an expat?
Well, yeah, I found that both historically and in a contemporary sense. So for the latter, I mean, I'm in Greece at the moment, working in Greece, and there's a huge community of Turks, of Turkish exiles who've left Erdogan's government. A lot of them are academics or journalists, and they really can't go back. They'll be arrested if they go back. But then there are the sort of the secondary category of doctors, lawyers, professionals who just don't see any hope for Turkey and they want to get out. And, you know, maybe they're trying to raise a family and they have no wish to do that in Turkey. So they come to Greece. And there is a real sense of loss among that community. They're very sad about Turkey.
So I wonder when that sense of loss turns to a sort of romanticism, as it has in that second or third generation.
It's too early for that to happen now. No one has any... I mean, people have nostalgia for Turkey as it used to be. No one has... No, none of the Turks who've had to leave Turkey that I encounter in Greece feel any desire to go back right now. But in terms of, as you say, the second or third generation, that turning into a kind of nostalgia and romanticism, I think that's definitely true. And, you know, I've definitely met... But, yeah, people like these Muslims in Bosnia and Serbia who think of themselves as Ottoman, and they don't speak a word of Turkish, but they want to learn because they think that's their connection to the great Ottoman past, and they think that's their connection to Turkey, and they're very keen to sort of... I remember going to a place in southern Serbia where there was a local guy who was a Muslim, and he had sort of what he thought of as Ottoman ancestry, and he was obsessed with Erdogan. He had flags of Turkey all over his walls. He had Turkish TV playing in his sitting room, even though he didn't speak a word of Turkish, didn't understand what they were saying. Didn't matter. He just felt like he wanted to feel Turkish, so he wanted to surround himself with all this Turkish paraphernalia. And he was in contact with Serbs, former neighbours of his, who'd gone off to live in Turkey. And it was amazing. He was like a kind of fanboy of Erdogan, and I just didn't get it.
Let's get the microphone out, if we may. If you've got a question for Alev, do stick up your hand. It might be about something we've talked about so far. We'll come to you first. It might be because you're thinking of a trip to Turkey or anywhere in the Ottoman, former Ottoman Empire. Yeah.
Am I on? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. I was thinking, politically, there's a lot of antagonism between Turkey and Greece. But is that the case amongst the ordinary people? You know, like you said, you lived in Greece for quite a while, and is that the case, or is it just amongst the, you know, the governments?
I think personally, I was expecting to feel a little bit more antagonism from Greeks when I moved to Greece as a Turk, and I really haven't had even a single negative comment. And it's quite nice, really. Everyone seems to agree that the main source of tension between the two countries is from their governments. And there's obviously a huge amount of tension there. And only recently, last summer, I don't know if you remember, there were these dogfights between Turkish and Greek pilots in the Aegean. And now there's a big fuss being made over drilling for oil near Cyprus and all sorts of things going on. And relations are not great at all. They never have been amazing. But I think socially, Turks and Greeks have so much in common, and most of them recognise that. And the ones who don't recognise that, I think, are a relative minority who live in the centre, who live sort of, you know, in Turkey, they will come from places in central Anatolia. They'll have never met a Greek person. They probably have never even met anyone who's met one, you know. So it's, there's just sort of an unknown people that they've got historical beef with. But anyone from the city, from the coastal areas or from the big cities, have almost certainly met at least one Greek or know of them. Or, you know, there's a lot more understanding because there's more contact between the two countries. And I find personally that they're actually, Greeks are quite excited when they hear I'm from Turkey, and they're, you know, it's nice. There's a feeling of closeness.
Other questions? Oh, yes. We're going to make Roddy run. Excellent.
When you were barred from Turkey, was there a particular line you think the government thought you'd crossed, or was it for one article? Or because it's obviously, you know, for most of the national papers here, they'll have a Turkey correspondent who's writing about Erdogan sort of day in, day out. I just wonder if there was a particular thing they... Or do you think they just sort of picked one journalist at sort of random?
No. Well, I mean, there have been quite a few, but in my case... So I was writing opinion pieces for The Guardian, and there was one in particular I wrote just after the coup attempt, in which I said there's a really nasty atmosphere, and I think there's going to be... You know, the state of emergency had been declared, and it was very clear that there was going to be a crackdown, and it was very clear that this was going to be an opportunity for the government to crack down on human rights. And I just expressed that in my piece. And at that point, there was such a sense of fervour among government supporters and, of course, within the government itself, that felt that they just fought off this threat. And how dare you detract from that by saying that this was in any way negative. And so tensions are running high. But, I mean, to be honest, I wasn't particularly popular before that anyway. And I was always getting death threats and so on. It's just, you get to a point where you recognise that there's more than usual and they're getting more extreme. The old death threat is really par for the course in that part of the world
And who do these death threats come from?
Well, they come from people on social media generally. I was very lucky. I mean, I never had a note through my door. The New York Times correspondent did, and she had to leave the country for a while, and when she came back she had security and so on. That was awful. I never had that, but at the same time you recognise that it's not impossible that they might find out where you live. And as a freelance journalist, I didn't have the protection of a bureau. I was really a kind of lone ranger, so I had to be a little bit more careful. And then, of course, when I found I was barred, I realised that I had been right in thinking that it wasn't the best place for me to be.
Other questions?
Just wondering if there's any chance of you getting back in anytime soon, and would you want to go back tomorrow if you could?
Well, I don't think I will be let back in, certainly under Erdogan. I would love to go back in an ideal world. Might not be the most sensible thing to do right now. There may be a court case against me. I'm not sure. I've tried to find out. But even if there isn't one recorded, it's often happening behind the scenes, and you can't find out. Even if, I've got friends who are lawyers who have tried to look into this, and it's just impossible to say. It's not a state that works in a transparent way. So it inevitably carries risk if you go back.
So what will you do next?
Well, for now, I'm in Athens. I'm based in Athens writing a new book and doing a little bit of journalism. And that's sort of my consolation prize for not being in Istanbul, I think. Athens is very similar in some ways. The culture, as I mentioned before, the cultures are quite close. I feel it has a sort of spirit of Istanbul about it, even if it's not exactly the same.
Well, thank you very much. She's taken us into the past, into the present, and into the future. It's been a wonderfully inspiring and informative 45 minutes. So thank you. Thank you to you for coming.
Thanks.
And for great questions. Alice Scott.